Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, Beaver Nation, and welcome to Beaver Banter, an Oregonian sports podcast. I'm Joe Freeman, senior writer for the Oregonian, and he's Nick Daschle, Beaver's beat writer for the Oregonian. And we're here to talk things, all things Oregon State. Nick, how you doing, buddy?
A lot on the table this week, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot going on out there. And, you know, you've done a podcast, an Oregon State podcast many, many, many times in the past, but we haven't done one in quite some time. So I'm going to join the fray here with you. Before we get too knee deep in Beavers, what did you watch the Super Bowl yesterday? How'd that go for you?
I watched the second half. I watched the golf tournament until it was over. I'm not a real big NFL guy. I love some of the PGA golf stuff.
You're here in a public forum to publicly acknowledge that you only watched the second half of the Super Bowl, and you did so for the Phoenix Open. You needed to finish the Phoenix Open.
Not only did I watch the second half, I was in the car during overtime because we were headed to Mass on Sunday night. So, yeah.
We're going to need to talk about your priorities and getting your priorities straight.
There was more people at the golf tournament than there was the Super Bowl. I'll tell you that.
I watched a little bit of that golf tournament. It's always a fun one. It's kind of one of the early season ones, but I'm not going to delay watching the Super Bowl for the end of that. Who ended up winning it?
Nick Taylor. He won in two second playoff hole. But the excitement was on 16, obviously, where Scottie Scheffler almost holed out, had a hole in one. If he had a hole in one, that would have been that's just instant viral video if that ever happens, because of all the water bottles and stuff that go flying onto the golf course from there.
Yeah, the beer cans.
Missed by about 8 inches.
Oh yeah. Yeah, those are always fun when they go nuts.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into this. Before we do get too deep here in the pod, though, let's do a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to start bringing you guys an episode of this podcast probably every week during the season here, and we'll kind of spread the wealth on the topics. Obviously, everybody always wants to talk about football, so we'll certainly do that as often as we can every week. We got spring football coming up here in about a month. And then, of course, today we have to talk about the red hot and rolling women's basketball team, which has suddenly and kind of surprisingly emerged as one of the best in the country. We've got kind of on the other end of the spectrum, the men's hoops team. And we'll even dive into a little baseball today. The baseball team plays their season opener later in this week. So like you said, we got a lot going on here, Daschle. So let's kind of get first into football. I know you and I independently at different times over the last few weeks have sat down with Trent Bray for kind of extended one-on-one interviews. I know you've also talked to both coordinators, Ryan Gunderson and Keith Hayward, to kind of pick their brains about what's coming, what's looming here with the program. And you know, with so much transition and coming off a little bit of so much uncertainty, but kind of things stabilizing a little bit, it seems like, I don't know how we put a bow on that. There's so much going on right now, but I guess I guess just what are kind of your prevailing thoughts on Trent Bray's first few weeks at the helm and kind of what's ahead for the program?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, mostly with Trent, it's been about rebuilding the roster. You know, with all the transfers that have come in, he really needed to do to restock pretty much every position, but maybe running back, and even running back has added a bunch of players. So it's been awfully busy there. As far as, you know, what he's going to do, I mean, that's just something that we're just gonna have to find out in a month when spring practice starts on March 5th. Everything you hear, everything he says sounds good. It's just unknowable, because until a guy is a head coach, you don't really know until you get some stuff on, to actually see what it looks like and all that, and how players react to him. And I mean, if college football is known for guys that are just coordinators or just assistant football coaches, and then guys that can actually be the head coach. It's not just because you're a great assistant coach doesn't mean you can be a great head coach. I think Trent seems to have the intangibles and the factors that would make him a good head coach. But, you know, this is stuff we'll be finding out here in the next, you know, months and years, actually.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that the jury's still out. So many times guys win the offseason, and you can do all you want to win the offseason. It might not matter once that first game rolls around. But I will say this, he just inherited the program at such a, completely insane time, an unprecedented time with so much upheaval and just seemingly every negative, difficult thing that possibly could go on. And I really feel like from the outside going on, and I certainly haven't covered Oregon State nearly as long as you have, it's hard to imagine someone kind of riding the ship as quickly or as, solidly as he seems to do. He stabilized the roster as best as he could. And obviously they lost a lot of transfers and they lost guys who are heading to the NFL or otherwise. And they lost some really, really key pieces. But he didn't seem to dwell on that, too much. He kind of hit the ground running, and I don't know where he told me that he ended up with 19 transfers, 15 college guys and 4 JUCO guys. But last time you talked to him, he said 17 transfers.
Well, there's 17. There's 2 guys that still are not on campus yet, but and they're supposed to be here for the start of spring quarter. So the big lineman from Colorado and the defensive tackle from Houston.
Gotcha. Okay.
They got to graduate. They got to finish their schooling and graduate is what my understanding is before they can come to Oregon State.
Gotcha. Okay. So he's completely remade the roster as you pointed out, kind of on the fly, which I found to be pretty impressive. One thing that I was really surprised with in my talk with him is, I had no idea what his expectations for the team were going to be. You would think that he would temper things down a little bit, but he kind of went, nuclear. He went the other way. He says his team is positioned. He thinks he has the roster. He thinks that their schedule is set up to chase a berth in the college football playoff, which I think everybody from the outside looks at and hears and thinks that he's insane, which I kind of said to him in my own way, well, how do you respond to those people? And he said, well, I totally get from the outside why you would look at that and think that. But, I think we've restacked the roster with enough capable guys, enough veterans in enough key positions. And again, that schedule, the independent kind of Mountain West hybrid schedule sets up where he thinks it's easier than, say, moving to the Big Ten or even the old Pac-12 schedule. And so, we'll see if his, high expectations come to fruition. But he was very adamant that this is not a rebuild. It is a retool. And in fact, that was kind of the message that he was selling on the recruiting trail to transfers, to high school kids, to everyone in between, even his own roster. He's like, look, we're going for this right now, and we have an easier path to kind of take Oregon State to a place it's never been.
Well, I would also say he doesn't really have a lot of he might as well say this anyway, because the bar is not at the same level as it was when Jonathan came in. When Jonathan came in, the place had crashed and burned, and the bar was so low, whatever Jonathan did was going to be met with, you know, yay from the fan base because it was so bad. Well, now they're coming off, you know, 10-win season, three bowl, you know, 10 wins since 2 years ago, three bowl berths, you know, all these high expectations. And shoot, I mean, if a 6-6 season in this next year is going to be met with a lot of nasty looks from the fan base, I would think that they're not going to accept 6-6, even though maybe that's reality. But I at this point, it's hard to know with the roster until we see what they can do. But so he might as well go for broke right now. I think with Trent so locked into football, I mean, his life is football, more so than most guys. They're all into football, but I mean, Trent is just like nonstop 24/7 football. And so, I mean, the other part I was going to say was about the college football playoff. To me, it all comes down to that Oregon game. If they win the Oregon game, they got a decent chance. If they don't win the Oregon game, it doesn't matter if they go 11-1. 11-1 with a loss to Oregon isn't going to get them in the top 12, I don't think. Not with the rest of the schedule they have. So they probably got – I mean, they got to feel like they got a team that can beat Oregon in Reser Stadium. Now, that's, you know, I mean, if I'm Trent, I'm thinking, sure, I got a team that can do that, but we won't know that until September.
Yeah. Yeah, and Oregon has had a remarkable offseason as well, both in the portal and they hauled in one of the nation's best recruiting classes too. So no one in this podcast wants to hear it, but they're kind of rolling over there. Now you recently kind of sat down with Ryan Gunderson and Keith Hayward independently. What kind of, you know, how did you walk away from those conversations? What was kind of their message? You know, obviously the offense, from my talk with Trey, it sounds like it's going to be quite a bit different there. From what he told me, they're kind of looking to be more multiple and more varied and less predictable. And, you know, it seemed to me that one of his big goals in hiring Ryan and the shift that he wanted to take with offense is Trent really felt that over the years, the one thing kind of holding the team back was when defenses stacked the box to kind of shut down Damian Martinez and the Beavers running game, they really didn't have a very good counter. And he really wanted to get someone who could counter that. And not just where, okay, we're going to have a play action or a play that gets one person open. And if that one person doesn't get open, you're screwed. He wants multiple options, you know, off those sets and those formations. And that was one thing I took away. But Trent told me that he found as a defensive coordinator, the hardest team to prepare for each season was UCLA and, you know, those Chip Kelly offenses. And obviously Ryan Gunderson has had a heavy hand in that the last couple of seasons. So I guess long-winded way to say, you know, well, can you expound on that a little bit? And then, you know, flipping sides to defense, what was kind of Keith's message there?
Sure. With Ryan, I mean, this the quarterback position has really evolved at Oregon State since 2018. I mean, when Trent first came in, you know, as an inside linebackers coach, and Jonathan was the head coach, I mean, they were married to a pro style quarterback. As time wore on, that, you know, they got Chance Nolan. They got a little look at him, see what he could do rolling out a little, you know, with a little bit of mobility. And then they got Aiden Childs. They could really see where this quarterback position. Now they're all in on the dual threat quarterback. The days of the Jake Lutons and Ben Gulbransons are probably over.
I don't think Ben wants to hear that.
No, Nick. I know he doesn't, but I mean, it just is what it is. It's they want to get guys, and that's kind of what Trent's saying. I mean, you could say, you know, you don't want to stack the box, but you got to have something there that you can, you got to have the player there's that could do that. And so you got to have a quarterback that can get out the pocket and be a run pass threat and on the edges. And with the guys they brought in, you know, McCoy and Jabari Johnson, those two guys are capable of that. Now, you know, we'll see if they, we'll see if McCoy can make the jump from Big Sky to this level, and whether Jabari Johnson is, you know, ready to play at this level. It, you know, you would think one of the two is probably going to work out to some degree. So, but that's what Ryan wants to do. He wants to be multiple, and he I tried to kind of pin him down as to what kind of an offense you have, and he didn't really, you know, it was a lot of the, you know, what's the defense going to give us, and they don't want to be predictable, and so there wasn't any, you know, great terms of I can really latch on to what this thing's going to look like. It could look like something different every week, but mm-hmm. I don't think that they're going to go strictly with the, you know, the offense you might have seen against Oregon, you know, 2 years ago, where they ran the ball exclusively in the second half of a game, even though you got a Martinez. I think they want to get the ball to the backs, you know, especially with, you know, Jam Griffin on the roster now, and some of these other guys they brought in. I think they're going to try to get the ball to the backs, and they're going to try to expand Damian Martinez's game some. The receivers, I mean, on paper, it looks like they got a good group, but again, they're unproven. So we'll just have to see how that evolves. But as far as Keith goes, he says some of the things you're going to hear out of most defensive coordinators. You know, we want to put pressure on the quarterback and, you know, not necessarily get him on the ground, but make him uncomfortable and things like that. I did ask him, I said, how much is Trent going to play a role in the defense? He said, well, you know, we know what we've got, but it, you know, and both Trent and Keith have said it's Keith's defense. And he says, you know, a lot of what Trent built is what he believes in, but there'll be some wrinkles. And of course I asked him, what are those wrinkles? And he didn't want to say, so he says, I guess you'll find out, but you know, so I'm guessing it's probably going to involve some movement up front more than anything else. So where they're bringing guys, different guys, different positions to attack the quarterback and things like that. But I suspect they want to get a little bit bigger on the defensive line. Just looks like from some of the guys they brought in, a little bit more size there. And then I asked him, you know, typically in the last 6 years, the defense has kind of funneled a lot of the plays to the inside linebackers, which is why you're seeing Oregon State's inside linebackers usually at the top of the list in tackles in the Pac-12. And he said, yeah, that would be a good place to go for us too. So I assume the defense is going to look a lot like what we've seen with probably some fingerprints of Keith Hayward on it. The, you know, the two issues with both these guys though is Ryan's never been a deep offensive coordinator. Can he? So we don't know. You know, he's got some background as a quarterback coach, and he's worked with, you know, developing offenses. But mm-hmm. this is his offense now. Let's see what he can do with it. You know, Keith has got some experience as a defensive coordinator. He was co-coordinator at Oregon. He spent 1 year at UNLV as a defensive coordinator. But he's still kind of young in his role as a defensive coordinator. Worked out well for Trent Bray. I mean, so there's reason to believe it could work out for Keith Hayward as well.
Yeah, and it's, you know, man, the modern college football, I can't imagine being a coach right now chasing transfers and two different transfer cycles simultaneously, you know, recruiting your own players to stay. And obviously that was a big, you know, storyline with this team this offseason with the high number of transfers that Trent had to haul out of the portal, you know, 19 guys or 15 at least from other colleges. And I was kind of interested in talking to him, and we did talk about it, is like, is this the new normal? Are you going to be chasing this many guys every year? And he was pretty emphatic that no, he doesn't want that to be the normal. I think the sweet spot for him is, you know, kind of 8 to 10 guys, depending upon needs, depending upon the roster, depending upon, you know, guys who defect and transfer elsewhere. That's kind of the sweet spot for him. He really wants to, you know, reinforce high school recruiting. He wants to kind of, you know, be a, you know, a team that is known for developing its talent and grooming them into replacing the guys that leave. And, you know, he really wants that to be the backbone of the program. I thought it was interesting. He was very forthcoming about, he's like, look, USC is going to come poach and buy our players. Other guys are going to come buy our players. USC got at least two guys in this cycle. They've gotten guys in the past. Florida State got two guys, you know, from this roster last year. So other teams are going to come, and after he develops, OSU develops them, they're going to come, and some guys are going to leave if they're chasing the bag or whatever. And he's very well aware of that. He's happy with where the NIL is. He's happy that players are getting paid finally. But his goal and the model that he wants to use is, okay, well, when somebody comes and poaches this guy, we're going to have the next guy in line ready to take his place. And so, you know, that's how college football has been built for decades and decades. And he doesn't want to get away from that just because of the transfer portal. But I mean, you'd be an idiot not to use the portal at this point, because that's where modern football is. And that's where you're going to be able to succeed, is kind of plugging holes and supplementing the roster with that. So I thought that was one interesting thing he said. I'll be interested to see how they recruit without the Pac-12. You know, can they recruit with their current standing? Are players going to buy into that? And, you know, he kind of shares his vision as it's like we talked about earlier. It's an opportunity, kind of an easier path because of the expanded playoff format. And I think every Oregon State fan probably believes, much like the athletic department believes, that this isn't going to be a permanent situation for them, that at some point they'll find a landing spot at another conference or depending upon how things shake up in the next 2 or 3 years here. So, I mean, it's kind of like keeping things moving ahead, if not projecting ahead forward, or moving up, I guess, or keeping things status quo for the next couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things I'd say or add to that is 19 transfers seems like a lot. And I know Trent says, you know, somewhere in 8 to 10 range. Again, how do we know? I mean, you got to do what you got to do. And if a bunch of guys leave, you got to find a way to fill those holes. So I know that's what he'd like to do. And in a perfect world, you'd like to get 6 or 8 guys out of the transfer portal. But I mean, if you got a good roster and you lose a bunch of guys, you gotta replace them. And so, even though you might have some guys ready to go, you gotta have all that depth and things like that. So, I think ideally that would be the formula, the 8 to 10. But I mean, in years where you got a good team and lose a bunch of guys, you're gonna have to hit the portal hard. So I think it's just gonna be a year to year thing. You know, as far as, you know, what we haven't even got to the second part of this, the spring. I mean, the spring's going to be pretty active too. You know, guys are going to spend their time in spring ball. They're going to assess where they're at and go, do I really want to hang out here and wait for August, or should I go look elsewhere? And some of these guys are going to say, yeah. And then there's going to be programs like Washington and Alabama that are just looking to rebuild their rosters, and they're going to start sending out feelers with six figure, you know, answers to their questions. And there's going to be guys moving. And so the spring's going to be interesting to see how that plays out when that window opens.
The whole, and I talked to him a little bit about the status of college football and the transfer portal, and he was pretty open about that as well. I didn't write a ton about that, but I mean, I think he feels, as pretty much everybody in college football feels, that it's the way things are set up right now is unsustainable. To have two portal windows and you know, to have to recruit your own guys twice, and you think you finally have a handle on your roster, and then spring comes around and who knows how it's going to blow up. I think the guys that he has are guys that want to be here. And I think the bulk and of his work and the hardest part of his work this season is over. Cause it is difficult to transfer in that spring. You know, you leave in the winter and you've got the spring, like right now they're doing, you know, their daily workouts and, you know, individual workouts and that kind of stuff. So they're getting ready for the spring and they're getting into the program and the culture and indoctrinating themselves to that and so on and so forth. And then they'll go through spring practices. So you'll feel like you have a handle on them and they'll have a handle on you. Well, when you transfer in after that, it's kind of going on, you know, on the fly. Especially for the big positions, quarterback and you know, stuff like that. I mean, you can add a wide receiver or maybe, you know, guys here and there. But spring, I have found, and maybe that's going to change, but the spring transfer portal window is a lot less, you know, insane as that winter one.
Oh, for sure. But the difference to me now is there's so much more. Guys are so much more brazen about making offers, and let's just say you're a holdover for, we'll just use Oregon State. It could be any school that has a new coaching staff or new coordinator or something. I mean, let's just say, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but let's just say Damian Martinez goes through the spring and he goes, man, I don't like the way this offense is. I don't like this offense. So I'm going to look elsewhere. I could see
everybody. Dashiell just predicted that Damian Martinez is
going to. I'm just using him for an example. But this could happen to a bunch of guys where they just go, "Yeah, I don't really like the way this is going. I think I'll go look around, see what else I can find after I've gone through the spring with this new coach to see what it actually will look like." That some of that's going to take place. I'm sure of it. I mean, like a guy like Ben Gulbranson. I could definitely see him going through the spring, looking to see how, you know, how Ryan is Gundy's using, you know, his quarterbacks, and making a decision at the end of the spring. You know, do I want to stick this out, or do I look elsewhere? Do I just go on to medical school? You know, I could see that's a real world situation. There is Gulbranson.
That's a real good point. And especially because of the newness of the staff and, you know, half a staff of new guys and a new program that probably looks a lot like the previous program and how it's run and organized, but has a lot of new wrinkles and new kind of philosophies on both sides of the ball at some level. Well, less on defense, but that's a good point. Well, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. You don't know how you jive with an OC or a DC and all that until you get in the fray. So that's a good point. Guys could kind of decide this isn't for me, I suppose.
And then, you know, with Trent, I you've talked to him about this too, but, you know, I asked him about, you know, his thoughts on what changes should be made to, you know, the recruiting and transfer portal windows and things like that. And he didn't seem too concerned about where things stood with recruiting. He didn't mind the early signing day, even though that's a huge controversial topic right now in college because of the CFP running square into the portal time and recruiting and all that. He didn't seem to think that was a problem. Where he has a problem is the two transfer portal windows. He says that's got to be fixed. I don't know how you fix that, be honest with you, just because of the first window. Guys got to make a decision before school starts in the winter time. So you can't really move that one too much. Now you could get rid of the second window. I don't know how that would fly. I think that would be a good move if they did get rid of the second window, but I think there'll be a lot of discussion on that one. The other thing I was going to bring up, though, was about recruiting. I could see this being an opportunity for Oregon State, all this transfer portal stuff. I could see them going to higher-ranked quarterbacks and things like that and saying, hey, you can come here and we can develop you and play you as quickly as you're ready to play, as opposed to some of these other programs that just keep bringing in new players, and they're just, especially at the quarterback position, where, you know, the Oregons just seem to sign a new guy they bring a new transfer every year, pretty much every other year. I mean, what chance does a freshman quarterback have at a place like Oregon or USC or any of those places anymore? So if you're Oregon State, you go, hey, come to our place and we'll develop you and we'll play you. Mm-hmm. I could see that pitch, and that's not, to me, it's an opportunity for Oregon State.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I mean, you just hit on the buzzword opportunity, which is what Trent is selling everybody on, that this is a unique opportunity and his vision for how things are going to go. And look, we're probably, what, 11, 12 weeks now into the Trent Bray tenure, and so this is all brand new, and we don't, nobody knows how it's going to go. But I will say that for what he inherited, both with the turmoil and upheaval, with guys bailing right and left and half the coaching staff leaving, and he himself scheduled to be on a plane to leave, you know, himself, I have been impressed with what he's been able to do. And if I were an Oregon State fan, as bad as things have been, and as, you know, unsettling as their kind of status is, it's hard to imagine it being in a better, more stable position than it is right now, at least temporarily. You at least have a guy who's, you know, he's got the background, he's got an appreciation, he's got a of the program, he's got a love of the town and the culture of the town and the program, and he has a vision for the future. And you know, that was one thing when I did talk to him. I talked to Damian Martinez, I talked to Jack Coletto, I talked to Mike Riley, I talked to Dennis Erickson, and they universally, praised the hire, and they all basically said that's who I wanted them to hire. And in fact, Mike Riley and Dennis Erickson both talked to Scott Barnes ahead of the hire and essentially said, hire Trent Bray. You know, if you want my opinion, that's who you should hire. And they're both still connected to the program, Mike Riley pretty heavily and Dennis Erickson, tangentially. And so, again, a terrible situation that has been kind of righted as good as it could be, at this point. Is there anything you want to wrap that up with football wise before we switch gears here?
No, I think we were just going to briefly go over what spring football, not too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah. So what, it opens March 5th, is that right?
Yeah, Tuesday, March 5th. It's going to follow roughly the same schedule that Oregon State's had over the last several years, where they practice three times a week for the first 2 weeks, take finals week and spring break off, and then return in April and go for 3 weeks and practice pretty heavy the last week leading into the spring game. It remains to be seen whether the spring game will actually be an event as opposed to the crap show it's been the last few years, where it's really not very entertaining or exciting to watch because it's not really a game. I think Trent would like to have a game, if he's able. It all depends on the health of the team. They do have a lot of They do have a lot of bodies in the program right now. So it'd be nice if we could see some sort of a game. It'd be great is if they had a game where, bring in some former players to be the the celebrity coaches and mm-hmm. really make a day, make an event out of it for the fans. But again, that's to be seen. I don't know. That was never Jonathan never was really into that stuff. I don't think he really understood how that could sell. I don't think he cared, but and Trent might be more into doing something like that.
Yeah, I think, all eyes will be on quarterback as much as anything. I mean, there's so many new faces. There's an overhauled, wide receiver room, the secondary. Both lines of scrimmage. There's so much to kind of, follow and track here to see how it progresses. But, the biggest kind of question mark there is at quarterback. And Giovanni McCoy and Ben Gulbranson obviously are the two guys there that are going to be, battling that out. I know the staff is very high on McCoy, who, threw for 55,550 yards and 43 touchdowns. At Idaho, and it's, you can say it's a step down in competition, which I did say to Trent Bray when I talked to him, and he said, well, you know, look, this guy played Cal and played other Pac-12 teams. He played Boise State, and he succeeded no matter who he faced. And you know, those college coaches certainly know more than me about, you know, recruiting and scouting guys for their own system. So I'll be interested to see how he adjusts to the step up in competition. And I know what interests me or piqued my, you know, curiosity is Oregon State had multiple former five-star recruits that have been in college programs for a year or more come through during the portal cycle. And they kind of kept watching film of all those guys, and they kept watching film of McCoy. And, you know, Trent and Ryan kind of talked, and they're like, why are we, what is it about these five-star guys that we're going after that sets them apart from this guy that we're watching do the things that we want on film? And, you know, through those conversations and through talking to all the guys, they decided that this guy McCoy, who wants to be here and is kind of shown it at least at a step down in competition, but at least at the college level, was their guy. So that's a pretty big ringing endorsement. And I'll be interested to see how he kind of shines in the
spring.
Well,
I think it's a perfect mix, really. They've got, you know, Gulbrandson, a guy who's been in the program, knows how to win. He's not, you know, obviously he's not flashy, but they at least know what they have with him. With McCoy, they got a guy that has played college football for a few years, has got a lot of video out there. They know what he can do. Then they got a guy that's sort of an unknown, but a lot of promise. And so you got these three guys that, you know, you can roll out there, and you got a lot of options. And so that, I think that'll be good for him.
Yeah, that's a good point. He kind of said, he made the point to me that the balance and where the guys are stacked for both now and in the future is exactly where he wants that room to be. A guy who's a veteran, a guy who's ready to play now, and then a guy who's, you know, going to develop and kind of be ready for what they want to do for the future. So, right. All right, well, we'll stop there. We'll switch gears a little bit. I mean, we could talk football the whole time, which is mostly what people want to listen to anyway. But, you know, we've got kind of, quite frankly, Oregon State women's basketball is one of the hottest teams in the country. They've won five in a row, including four against top 20 opponents, kind of, you know, leaping into third place in the Pac-12 at 9-3 in the conference. So with six games left, they're just a game and a half behind first place Stanford. So it's kind of been a team on the rise, a team that's playing a fun brand of basketball, a team that's been fun to watch. You know, during the streak, they squeaked by rival Oregon, and then, of course, defeated Utah and Colorado two times each. The most recent win came Sunday at Colorado. I should say we're recording Monday morning, so a little context for you there. But so their last win came yesterday, and it was their first road victory against a top five team in program history that went at Colorado. So really impressive there. They're looking for their first tournament berth since 2021. And the craziest, insane part to me is that they were predicted to finish 10th heading into the season in the Pac-12. So, Dasha, where did all this come from? What's the secret behind this Beavers team's success? Why are they so much better than everyone expected?
Well, this is part of where this goes back to, again, is the transfer portal. You know, there was a 21 was the last year they went to the NCAA tournament, and in the couple years after, you know, a few years after that, they went through their first real run with the transfer portal where they lost players. And Scott's whole deal, the way he builds programs, is he has those players around for 4 years, and by the time they get to be juniors and seniors, they know the system, they know what he expects on defense, they know what roles they need to play. And he lost that 2 years ago when a bunch of players left for different Duke, you know, good programs, Duke and Texas and Michigan and things like that, but they left, and he had to kind of retool. Well, he had this really good freshman class come in last year, a couple of five-star players, Reagan Beers and Tamia Gardner, and then some shooters and whatnot. And, you know, they had to learn last year, and so they were young and didn't, and they had they were competitive, but they get in close games and they couldn't finish. Well, now they're a little bit older, and then they brought in these two freshmen from in-state, Hunter from Barlow and I mean from Medford and Candy Schuler from Barlow. I mean, they've been tremendous as freshmen. They're still freshmen, but they've blended in with a roster that's starting to mature. And I'm telling you, they look like a Final Four team. I mean, they have so much length and so much depth and so many options on the offensive end, and their defense is as good as any. It's the best in the Pac-12, and it's one of the top, at least defending field goals, which is what Scott really leans on, his field goal defense. It's number three or four in the country. I don't know where they were four yesterday. I don't know if they're still there or not, but I mean, they got out on these four games they played with Colorado and Utah the last 2 weeks. I mean, they blasted Utah both times, and Colorado, they're up 25 in the third quarter yesterday. I think the altitude and just kind of, knowing it was kind of over and you don't really know what to do when you're up that big on the road had something to do with that fourth quarter. But I mean, it sets up for that game on February 29th against Stanford to be, if they can get through this weekend and then they got to go to the Washington schools. If they can get through these next 2 weeks, that Stanford game is going to be as big a game as there's been at Gill Coliseum in probably 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. And so much of basketball is momentum. And, you don't want to win your first 10 and then, go 4-6 in your last 10, but you really kind of, you feel what you talked about is they've got some young talent, they've got some vets, and it's all kind of come together, and, they're playing their best at the perfect time. A Final Four team, you're not predicting that, but you're saying that is the potential of this team. I guess, what do you kind of peer into your
basketball? Because of the options they have on the offensive end, they don't have to just go into Reagan Beers or rely on a point guard to make plays or a couple of shoot. They've got three or four players that can shoot from three. They've got the interior game. They got Tamia Gardner, who's just been, she's just developed into a beast on the boards. Talia Von Olhoffen, who's the veteran of the team, has been around 4 years. She's just been great at the defensive end. And like I said, the defense is good, but the other reason they got a shot to be a Final Four team is the way this is setting up. They may not have to leave the state until the Final Four. Mm-hmm. If they get a top four seed, they can play in Corvallis the first two rounds. And if they get put in the Portland regional, which is a 50-50 proposition, because there's only two regional sites. I mean, then they got the Moda Center to play, the regional semi and possibly regional final. I mean, it's a good situation for them. We'll see how this goes, but right now, I mean, every week they just seem to be better. And I know I've heard of a few people wondering, are they peaking too early? And I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't think so. You worry about those teams that are playing great in December that peak early. Plus they have so many players they can rely on that if somebody does hit a bad patch, they got somebody else going to step right in and fill a spot. So that part I wouldn't be too concerned about.
Well, on the other kind of the opposite end of the spectrum where there are lots of concerns is the men's program. Beavers are 11-13 over and all, tied for last in the Pac-12 with USC. Kind of offered a little bit of hope 2 weeks ago with that surprising sweep of the Arizona schools. And now, yikes, those wins have been sandwiched by 10 losses. A 6-game losing streak and a 4-game losing streak. And it's really difficult to imagine things turning around at this point. The good news is that OSU is scoring more than my 8-year-old daughter's team. But the bad news is they haven't topped 60 points in the last 3 games. really can't generate any, you know, consistent momentum on that end of the floor. This isn't a surprise, I don't think, but I don't know. How would you kind of assess where the program is right now and kind of what are you looking for? What are you looking for the last couple weeks here?
Yeah, I mean, they were picked to finish 12th in the Pac-12, so it's not like, you know, it's not like 11 and 13 should cause people, you know, great concern. But I think that Arizona series, you know, got some people's hopes up. I mean, let's just look at them. Talent-wise, who are they better than? You know, they got a few players that you would really want, but I don't know, top, you know, from 1 to 8 or 9, that are they better really talent wise than anybody else? But they're good enough to compete. The issue in men's college basketball, though, is experience, and that's going to be less of an issue going forward once we get through the COVID period, where you can get that extra year of eligibility. It's the better teams these days have got a lot of fifth year seniors and fourth year juniors and players that have been in college basketball for a long time. Oregon State doesn't have that. They're relying mostly on second year guys. And so there is an experience thing, and I know it's an excuse, but there's something to it. Washington rolled out, I want to say, 4 seniors on Saturday that have been playing 4 or 5 years. I mean, that matters, at least in college basketball, it does. I don't know. I just think they got to – I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I honestly don't know what Oregon State can do. They can't really afford to make a coaching change. It's just too expensive. I mean, you can't go to the state crying poverty and we need help and then pay a guy $8.7 million to leave. I mean, I don't think unless some donor comes in and says, here's a check, you know, let's make a change. I don't think there's gonna be a change. And I don't know. I think in a perfect world, you probably do make a coaching change, but I don't think they can afford to do that at this point. And I think they can work their way out next season if they can keep most of these guys on the roster and bring in a few additions to where they'll be playing in a little more manageable situation in the WCC.
Yeah, it's really many of the programs have had a very impressive or at least commendable, finale in the Pac-12. You know, they're kind of going out on a high in a way. I mean, the men's soccer team was exceptional. The football team had a good season. You know, women's basketball is excelling. We're going to get into baseball later. They have very high expectations. And then you kind of have this very discouraging, disappointing end to the Pac-12. But it will, for the men's basketball team, it will be interesting to see how that transfers to the WCC, where, you know, it is on that next level of annually of basketball, you know, talent. It's kind of a rung below the major conferences, obviously with Gonzaga and St. Mary's and, you know, insert your team here that sparkles that year, Santa Clara and so on. But I mean, they shouldn't be 12th in the WCC. The question is, how high can they climb in the WCC, which is, you know, a pretty good basketball program.
That would be a trick to be 12th in WCC with 11 teams. But
exactly.
But maybe that's how bad these guys are. They're so bad. Exactly. They can finish 12th in an 11 team. No. I mean, the most discouraging thing for Oregon State fans is what they're seeing at Washington State. Washington State lost virtually everybody that was good on their roster a year ago. They've got no fan base. They've got the worst attendance in the Pac-12 this year. They don't have much of an NIL program yet. Kyle Smith went out and rebuilt that team, brought in whatever transfers he needed, and they're a game out of first place in the Pac-12 and probably going to go to the NCAA tournament. It's an exact comparison to Oregon State, and it's working at Washington State this year. Why can't Oregon State do that? Now, I mean, Oregon State people might come back and say, well, when was the last time they went to the Elite Eight? Well, okay, but that was a one-off. I, I, I don't know. I just see this Washington State team and I go, you know, why is this happening at Oregon State? And so that's a question I think a lot of people are wondering about.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and kind of wrap things up here with a quick look at the baseball team. They open the season later this week with four games and surprise. And then they will move on to Arlington, where they're going to play some very intriguing games against the likes of Arkansas and Texas Tech and Oklahoma State and Michigan. They kind of enter the season as a unanimous top 10 team, as high as 5, I think as low as 9 in all those polls. And there is great optimism in that program right now to kind of go out on top in the final year of the Pac-12. It's a program that every year says they have championship aspirations, and this year they really do have a team capable of making it to Omaha. They are they are loaded on offense. They insiders Ryan Gibson and Mitch Canham and many players, they feel like this could be the best, definitely the best offense in Mitch Canham's 5 years, but Gibson thinks it could be the best offense in program history, which is a ridiculously bold statement considering some of the offenses that have gone through there. But, you know, there's some talent there to back it up. Obviously, Travis Bazan is the headliner. He's coming off one of the best individual seasons in school history, and he then went on to win MVP of the Cape Cod League, which is a very prestigious summer baseball league. And, almost every MLB draft board for the 2024 draft has him as a top 3 or top 5 pick. There's even been some floating him as a number 1 overall pick. So he's that good. And it's not just him. I mean, the offense is, you know, 2 years ago, they had an incredible team with Jacob Melton and Wade Meckler and Justin Boyd, and Bazana was a freshman, and it was just a ridiculous offense. And this one really does have the potential to be better than that. They've got a really good freshman, Trent Carraway, who's supposed to be Gavin Turley Jr. Gavin Turley obviously was the freshman who blew up last year. He returns. And then a couple of guys kind of wanted to get drafted, weren't selected and returned. And that's Micah McDowell and Brady Casper. And so you add them back into the lineup with Turley and Bazana and Carraway and Mason Guerrera, who will move over to first base this year. And then they added a really good transfer shortstop, Elijah Hainlein, who was an honorable mention all Pac-12 guy who hit 10 home runs, 12 home runs last year for Wazoo. And there's a lot of power, there's a lot of speed, and just a lot of runs to be scored in that lineup. So there are some questions on the pitching staff. Their ace is expected to be Aiden May, who's a transfer from Arizona. He was really up and down last year at Arizona, but everybody in the program insists that a change of scenery from that thin air and quick infield there at Arizona and you know, the offensive, you know, ballpark that he pitched in to Goss Stadium is going to make a world of difference for him. He's also, he was a JC transfer. That was his first year pitching in the Pac-12. And so, you know, a year of experience should help him too. But, I was talking to Jacob Kamatz, who's going to be in their weekend rotation, who was incidentally, high school best friends with Aiden May and was a big factor in kind of recruiting him when he entered the portal. And Aiden May says he thinks he's going to hit 100 this year on the gun. So he throws fast. He's got an assortment of pitches, and they're really bullish on him kind of emerging as the ace. And that's really, you know, pitching depth and pitching top-end pitching talent was what held this team back last year. And they have a lot of good returners and an infusion of a couple transfers and talented freshmen that kind of make – you know, pitching coach Rich Dorman and Mitch Canham think that the staff is a lot better than other people think. So, high expectations there. Season starts this season, and we'll have a lot more time to talk about that.
One thing I was gonna mention. I'm curious. The single game tickets went on sale today. Boy, it looks bleak for for tickets on the website.
Oh, like finding tickets?
Yeah,
I wouldn't doubt it.
Maybe some of them are still locked up as they're still trying to sell season tickets. But yeah, I know the singles went on sale today, and between that and women's basketball selling $4 tickets for this weekend's games, I imagine the ticket people at Oregon State are a little busy today.
Happily busy, though.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Well, obviously, happily busy, but a little busy today between those two. I mean, plus, you know, they're trying to peddle season tickets for football too. But those two are immediate. So,
yeah. Well, and you think of, I mean, they're two of the more successful programs that Oregon State has. Obviously, baseball is kind of the shining star there in the athletic program, and this is it for the Pac-12. And so, you know, with all of that looming overhead with the expectations with baseball, and now the sudden increased expectations for women's basketball, it should be interesting to see how they go out. I guess I can mention really quickly before we wrap this up that a lot of details are still to be emerged, but, you know, we reported a couple weeks ago that baseball has decided to go with an independent schedule starting in 2025 rather than join the WCC as most of the other programs have. And so, you know, talking with Mitch and others in the program, they're pretty confident that they can put together a highly competitive schedule, which will, you know, kind of satisfy the RPI standards that would need them to put them in position to host a regional and a supers and all that stuff. So there will be a lot more to report on that when they finalize the schedule, which could come, you know, sometime later this month. We'll see how that's wrapping up. But my understanding is that they have a lot of pieces in place for that schedule, but they just have to wait out to when the other conferences finalize their conference schedule because you know, any conference that has an odd number of teams will have an open weekend in that schedule. And Oregon State is looking to pounce on those opening weekends to balance their schedule and kind of put the puzzle pieces together for teams in the big Big Ten and in the Big 12 and some of the old Pac 12 teams and then some of the, you know, teams along the West Coast that are prominent in baseball, maybe not some other sports. So keep an eye on that out for finalized things with that, and keep an eye out for basketball coverage this weekend, baseball coverage this weekend, and football coverage year round. Nick, is there anything you want to add before we?
I was just going to say one other thing I was wondering about baseball. I know I wrote about this last year, and I don't know where it's at, but they were definitely looking into premium seating at Oregon State, much like they have, or at Goss, much like they have at Reser. And I don't know where that stands, but I would think that was a year ago. I would think that they're probably, you know, far down the road in terms of determining whether that's feasible or not. And I would think just given the interest in the program, I mean, they could hit that pretty hard with some, you know, maybe, I don't know, 200-400 premium seat options, something like that, you know, where it is like it is a Reser with the, you know, the really, really nice suite, living room boxes, things like that. I don't know where that stands, but I guess that's something to keep an eye out for here down the road.
Yeah, I know Mitch has some grand plans that he always hides when I go into his office with. I mean, they've got schematics and they've got some expansion. I don't know if expansion is the right word, but some enhancements in mind. They're kind of in the process of that. They are and have broken ground on a new hitting facility. So when you do go to Goss Stadium, you know, it will have a different look when you look out from the seats. Those massive trees that were out in center field are gone. They're going to build it's either a 2 or 3 story building out there with a hitting facility and a meeting room and, you know, some cages and some areas to warm up there. So that will be something new. That probably won't be finalized and built this season. There was some hope that it might happen, you know, midway through. You know, the construction company and the workers are baseball fans, so they're trying to grind away and get it up as quickly as they can. But I think the target is kind of for the start of 2025, or at least the off season there for that. But yeah, I know they do have some grand plans for Goss and making it an even, you know, better and a better experience there. Right. So. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks so much for listening. Check out OregonLive.com/Beavers for all your Beavers coverage from Dashiell and myself. And again, we will talk to you weekly for this as often as we can. So stay tuned for another one of these next week. In the meanwhile, enjoy your Beavers. We'll talk to you later.